Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. One of the jewels in the St. Louis Zoo Museum District orbit is the Missouri History Museum. It was tarnished a year and a half ago when then-executive Bob Archibald left under fire for a questionable land deal and, to some, an even more questionable compensation package. Well, things settled down under interim CEO Bob Cox, and now there is a new president and CEO. That's Dr. Frances Levine. She comes to us from New Mexico, where she was the New Mexico History Museum's director. She's been on the job here for a relatively short time and is probably still getting her sea legs. In the process, she's making history, not only as the first female to head the History Museum, but as the first woman to lead any of the Zoo Museum District's institutions. She comes at an exciting time for the museum and for all of us as the city observes its semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary. Dr. Frances Levine, welcome to the program. May I call you Fran?
Yes, please do. I'm so happy to be here.
I love to use the word semi-quincentennial.
I would trip over those syllables.
And I often do. Well, belated welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you.
Was I accurate in saying you're probably still getting your sea legs?
Oh, you know, I think the first year that you're in a new place, everything is new. You know, it's the first time that I've had spring in St. Louis. First time I've gotten to enjoy Shakespeare in the Park. So everything is new. And I think I'm still figuring out where things are in the community and still appreciating so much that St. Louis has to offer.
When you say you're appreciating spring, I know part of that is because you come from New Mexico, where spring is sometimes a little hard to find.
You know, spring in New Mexico is usually wind and increasing right. heat. So I've appreciated the diversity of shades of green.
What else was it about St. Louis that attracted you and enticed you to come to our community?
You know, as I started thinking about what I wanted in my next career move, I thought about mostly what I needed to have in the community and in the museum I was going to. I wanted to be in a museum that still had connection to the history that I've done for 30 years in New Mexico. And so the roads and trails and the military history of St. Louis and Santa Fe and New Mexico are very much connected. Mm-hmm. I really wanted a community with a commitment to arts and culture, and I've found that enormously here. It had to be a livable scale, and St. Louis has a wonderful scale, and it still had to have that regional feel. It had to be a place that I call authentically home to its citizens, and that's one of the things I love about St. Louis are the neighborhoods. And it had to be a place where I could find a place in community and feel comfortable living here. And I have a little checklist, and St. Louis gets high marks for everything.
Sounds like it met your has met your expectations during the first couple of months.
Yes, it's meeting it very much.
Was the fact that we were observing our 250th anniversary, did that have any bearing on your decision to come?
You know, I think it was a fortuitous time to come. Mm-hmm. And part of it, it's almost like every day. Part of everything being new every day is every day I can read about something different in our history. I get to walk downstairs through our exhibition and read about a different person, a different event, a different artifact, a different building. And so the 250th, I've jokingly said, you mean it wasn't planned for me? Because it's given me what I need to know to begin to learn about the community and the region.
Well, the museum, obviously, and for obvious reasons, is very heavily involved in all of this. Has traffic increased as a result of it?
Oh, my goodness. We are doing great. And within the next few days, we'll reach 120,000 visitors since we opened on Valentine's Day. And that's about 1,000 to 1,200 visitors every day. That's great. Our restaurant is hopping. Our kids' programs are hopping. And that's one of the joys that I get as a museum director is to see how many different people are in the museum every day. So the 250 exhibit, we call it 250-250, and that exhibit is really bringing people, and they're coming back time and again. And I think that Jody Sewell, who's our curator, really touched the heart of the community in creating that exhibit.
He's been a guest on this program on several occasions. It's always a pleasure to have him. With the traffic you're getting, how much do you know? How much of a percentage higher that is than what you would normally have?
You know, museum attendance, of course, it depends on the exhibition. So when they did Lewis and Clark, we were right up or there in these kind of numbers. When they did the Mastodon or Mammoth exhibit, those numbers were really high. So it's museum attendance is seasonal. It's tied to exhibitions. But 250 is giving us a sustained higher attendance level.
Your course of study as a student was archaeology and anthropology, correct?
Yes, it was historical archaeology and anthropology. Well, when I first started, it was obviously prehistory because, you know, the oldest archaeology I could find in the Southwest, which was Paleo-Indian. And then gradually, I became more interested in historical archaeology because I could also bring in oral history and talk to people who'd been participants in events, and that made a big difference.
And your PhD is in anthropology?
My PhD is in anthropology and in a field called ethnohistory, and I worked with Hispanic communities in New Mexico about settlement and land use on some land grants. And you have those kind of land grants here.
Oh, yeah.
Also,
how does this particular course of study lead to running history museums?
Well, a lot of my undergraduate work was in museum collections. But when I, at that point in life, almost everything for women was about cataloging and washing artifacts and labeling artifacts. Women were not in leadership positions, and that didn't sit well with me. And so archaeology really gave me the opportunity to – I was also one of the first women on some archaeological projects. And so I've been fortunate in my career when it occurred that it allowed me to break out of those molds. But what ethnohistory allowed me to do was to realize that history is not either only what's in books, it's not only what's in artifacts, it's also the stories that people tell. So then I started working on museum exhibitions as a consultant. And so that I think they say if you're lucky, each day leads to the next, and it's a learning experience for the next phase.
I suppose it was not lost upon you in considering this job here that you would be the first woman to head the institution.
I didn't know that.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that, and I didn't know that I would be the first woman to head any ZMD institution. It seemed rather remarkable to me to even be having those conversations at this point in time that we are still counting the first first of that.
And I think for the next couple of years, at least, it's going to continue given what's going on in the political front with the potential of Hillary Clinton running for president. Fred, I know you came here to talk about the future, and we certainly want to do that, but we have to address the past as well. And that would, of course, be the Bob Archibald situation that I mentioned earlier. Bob Cox happens to be a personal friend of mine, he and his wife, and I know he did a fine job during the interim here. But what sort of a stain, if that's the right word, did that whole thing leave on the operation at the museum?
You know, internally, I have to say, Don, that what I think it did was it brought the staff together, maybe in ways, in Spanish we say, no hay mal que bien no venga. Okay, there's no bad thing that doesn't bring something good with it. Mm-hmm. So there was a learning for the staff in how to work together. I think that certainly some people are very concerned about the use of public funds. So that's given us even more transparency in how we spend ZMD funding. It's given us that line between the ZMD funding and the Missouri Historical Society endowments and being very clear about what they're used for and how they're used. So it's given us the opportunity and the responsibility to be very, very transparent in that. I think when you look at the staff, it's brought them together. It's diversified the voice of who speaks for the museum. And I think that's also my management style, is that it's not just me who represents a museum in this community. It's Jody. It's Sharon Smith, who's working on the Prohibition exhibit. Mm-hmm. It's Melanie Adams who does our community education programs. It's given us all an understanding of shared responsibility and shared messaging about the museum. I think it's true with the board and the ZMD trustees, is that they're all talking to each other, maybe more than they did. It's not revolving around one person.
It's certainly important to this community, given the amount of attention that this particular situation raised. But one of the things that I wonder about is that there are two boards involved. There's the History Museum Board and then the ZMD, Zoo Museum District Board. How well do they communicate? Isn't it still possible for the History Museum Board to operate with a lesser degree of transparency, perhaps?
You know, I come from a system in New Mexico that had the same setup. There was a state board that was appointed by the governor, and then there was a board that worked on our foundation side. So they were appointed by and nominated by people who were supporters of the museum. What it really needs, and all museums need this, is that public-private partnership. I would say that I never had the sense, either in my interviews or since I got there, that our boards are two separate boards, because they meet together, we make policy together, we make decisions together. And that's what I've seen right from the get-go in my interview. Was two boards wanting to be sure that we had both the transparency that is required of us as an institution that accepts public funds, and we want the stability that comes from having donors who support the museum. So I haven't seen that polarization, and I haven't seen the boards acting independently. I've seen them acting in concert right from the day they did my first interview.
As a newcomer coming in, do you see the need for any other changes that would enhance transparency and enhance the lines of communications?
I haven't seen it yet, but we're still looking at that, how that works. But everything we do now, we're sure that there is ZMD and Historical Society communications. There are some things that are paid for out of Historical Society funds in terms of training for the staff. I'm very big on and proactive on making sure that our staff goes to professional society and association meetings. And that's not paid for out of ZMD funds. That comes out of Historical Society funds. Acquisitions we do out of Historical Society funds. So we're very, very conscious of that. And maybe if I see a need for anything, it's for the community to understand that we understand that, and that there are and that we operate clearly so that people know how we're working and where we're working. But I haven't seen confusion of role yet at all.
Right. Was donor support lost during this period?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course. And that's one of the things that I'll be working very hard to bring back. I would say that community support has remained really strong. And I think of the Missouri History Museum as the living room of the community. And if you come on Tuesday nights to see Twilight Tuesday, when we do those, everyone's there. Everyone is there. And they're having a great time. And our board members are there. And our cleaning staff is there. And everyone is celebrating the music and the culture of the cultures of this community.
Just explain that event for listeners who don't know exactly what it is.
Twilight Tuesday is sponsored by Ameren, and we bring in usually St. Louis musicians, and they perform on the Lindell Lawn of the museum. We just finished our 6-week series that we do in the spring, and then we'll do it again for 6 weeks in the fall. We lay off during what I understand is the hot season here.
Oh, you'll find out.
That's what
all
I've heard.
That. It's a little late this year, but it will arrive. Fran Levine, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Fran is the new CEO and president of the Missouri History Museum in Forest Park, one of the jewels of the Zoo Museum District. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We'd like to get you into it as well. Come on in if you'd like at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with Fran Levine in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with the new CEO and president of the Missouri History Museum, Fran Levine, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A federal judge has granted a stay of execution today for Missouri death row inmate John Winfield less than a week before his scheduled execution. Winfield was scheduled to die at 12:01 a.m. Wednesday for killing two St. Louis County women in 1996. Missouri's budget concerns are continuing to mount. Attorney General Chris Koster's office says the state cannot count on receiving $50 million of tobacco settlement proceeds in time to be used during the 2015 budget year that starts July 1st. And union workers at Schnucks, Deerberg's, and Shop and Save have ratified a 3-year contract with the supermarkets. The United Food and Commercial Workers Local 655 represents roughly 9,000 members working at dozens of stores and pharmacies in the area. You can find out more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Fran Levine. Another question that will pop up, and you've probably been asked to answer already, Fran, is the question of the potential for having to charge admission to the History Museum. Is that ever going to happen?
Well, you know, we charge now just for special exhibitions, yeah. And that's because special exhibitions are usually traveling exhibitions or ones that we mount on our own. And so we charge those ticketed prices to help defray some of those expenses. But I think one of the great treasures of the city is the Zoo Museum District. It's the envy of the nation. And having that support, I think, means that I can't see us ever charging admission for our core exhibitions, for some of our, you know, we have to charge for some of our programs. We have to charge for some of our special exhibitions, unless somebody would like to match the Zoo Museum District's money with a special pledge.
That's about $10 million a year.
It
is that correct?
Yes.
What sort of a budget do you have?
Our budget is $14 million a year. And so 10 of it comes from, and that's when we're just doing base programming. That is $10 million from the Zoo Museum District and $4 million that comes from donations, member support, those kinds of things. Now, if we want to do bigger programming, bigger exhibitions, then, of course, we have to do more fundraising to get us up above that $14 million level.
Give me some sense, if you would, as to what it costs to put on a big exhibit.
A
big exhibit, yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk about the one that's opening in October. That's Louisiana Purchase, because it's a big one and it's an important one. I mean, it's the Louisiana Purchase, of course, is the reason we're speaking English and not French. And that exhibit is going to cost us about $300,000 to produce. Well, if you're saying, but it's just documents. Those are documents that are coming to us from the National Archives. Those documents require special couriers. They require special cases that we're having to build. They require special temperature and humidity conditions that are monitored hourly as they're in the exhibitions. So we're getting 10 documents from the National Archives. That means 10 cases. That those 10 cases can cost $4,000 or $5,000 a piece so that they are sealed correctly, that they have the right temperature and humidity controls in them. Hmm. We have special lighting conditions that we have to reach. And then my particular addition to the exhibit is that I want us to be able to carry some of the text in Spanish, English, and French, because that's the way the documents were negotiated and produced. So there's interpretation and transcription and translation fees for every one of the documents. We want to do some engaging exhibit points. We call them decision points, you know, the what would you do questions, where visitors get to put themselves in that time and place and all of the media that we use in exhibitions. You know from your years in television that every minute of producing a video is $6,000 or $7,000 a minute. So every time we have a video in an exhibit that helps to explain the interpretation, it also drives up the fee.
Yeah. What about the insurance of these documents and these artifacts? I mean, it must be an enormous expense there.
It is. And, of course, from the moment they leave the National Archives to the moment they leave the History Museum to go back to the archives, we insure them. So there's – but, you know, that's built into our sort of annual operating fee for insurance. But it's expensive to bring an exhibit, and then we do the programming in support of the exhibits, the advertising that we have to do. So there's you know, about $200,000+ in expenses to do the design and installation of an exhibit. Then there's the marketing and the programs to bring the speakers.
When we're talking, one more item about insurance, are individual items insured, or do you insure the entire block of whatever is coming?
Well, the museum has an insurance policy that insures its all of its collections and all the things that travel into it, and we work with our insurance agency every year to evaluate what's in the museum. I hate talking about this stuff because I'm always afraid it's like going to bring the lightning, you know.
Well, I'm always so glad to hear a guest say they hate talking about something I've just brought up. It makes for a somewhat stilted conversation.
Well, it's hard. It's hard. But, you know, we are constantly in communications with our insurance coverage.
How much input do you have as the president and CEO of whatever is decided upon for an exhibit?
Well, of course, when I came in, the exhibit schedule is set through 2015, but I started talking right away. I think maybe the staff was surprised that I came with opinions, and I should say I was born that way. And so I started right away to talk about what's in the exhibits that are coming in, to getting some of my ideas across. One of my ideas is that there always has to be places for family dialogue in a history museum. So you can't write it to such a high level that a family, that a mom and dad can't explain to their children what's going on, or that children can't explain to their parents what they've just seen. So you'll start seeing some differences in level of scripting. And I like to see what I call family script through it. So there are some places in there, not just the decision points, but some things where we're pointing out to teens, some things about like using the portrait of one of the Leclerc family members as a teenager and having him tell part of his story, so that a teen understands what it was like to live in this period of time when there was the change between French, Spanish, and American sovereignty. I like to have a place where I'm showing, where we'll use some points to show the signatures on the documents, and we'll talk about why people in Spanish colonial, French colonial, and American colonial times use these elaborate signatures. There's a story there, and if we don't point it out, we miss an opportunity for what I call teachable moments.
Okay, you've got me. What is the story behind the elaborate signature?
And those are called rubrics. And if you've ever noticed, like Amos Stoddard, we're going to be using Amos Stoddard's signature and his rubric. And in the colonial period, people authenticated their own signature by having not just the way they wrote their letters, but they would do a flourish. And that was like their seal. Very hard to counterfeit. Mm. And many historians who know about this create their own rubrics. And it's but they're very interesting. And when you look at these historic documents, you're going to be noticing the rubrics that different famous people used.
With regard to the things you're talking about that you'd like to do, making use of new media, new technology, and that sort of thing, this has got to be changing the way that museums and institutions such as yours are going to be doing business in the future. It has to.
Absolutely. But one thing, there are a couple things. One is that people love the idea that they see the actual object. You know, at the Smithsonian, the most famous object are Judy Garland's red sparkle shoes from Wizard of Oz. In our history museum, people come in and they want to see a particular object. The other day I saw dueling pistols from the 19th century. Well, we all know about duels that took place, but here is this beautiful set of dueling pistols. And people must know about Bloody Island that was in the center.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah.
Center of the Mississippi River right here. And we've got dueling pistols. If people would love to see it. Right now in the Prohibition exhibit, we've got that great Anheuser-Busch car, that promotional car. It's just a fabulous piece. So there's nothing will ever take the place, I don't think, of seeing that true object. But we have to use different ways. Now, in our History Clubhouse exhibit right now, we're not using any technology at all. And nobody's missing it. But that exhibit is what we call a prototype. And this is something new for museums where we prototype, we put it in an exhibit, and then we let it run for 6 months, 7 months, and hold community forums on that room. And we've done that in the History Clubhouse. We've had the first of several different community events where it's an adults-only night to play in the clubhouse and tell us what engages you. We've done it for caregivers. So that's another way that museums build exhibits. And sometimes the community feedback is, we don't want so much technology. We don't want to hear so many different soundscapes in a museum. It's a reason sometimes we use headphones, is sometimes people don't like hearing voices. They want an exhibit to be quieter.
But, you know, I would think that technology in general, and the internet in particular, would hurt in that if I want to see dueling pistols, I can Google dueling pistols. If I want to see certain documents, I can Google those documents and see them. I wonder if there's a danger that that can
Sure, absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. That the internet puts the world and the entire expanse of human history and beyond human history on view. But for some people, it's not the same. They can see a picture of the dueling pistol or the wedding gowns, you know, the first lady's gowns at the Smithsonian are a big exhibit item. Here for us, the 250 exhibit, I can tell you that people are loving seeing the Browns uniform or the Ted Drews early uniforms. And I think for some people, the internet is one experience, but seeing that real thing is the other.
Is there something that you've always wanted to do that maybe you're now in a position to do, an exhibit, something that you'd like to really concentrate on and bring to us that you've always wanted?
Oh, I think a couple different things. One is an exhibit on the history of the Mississippi River, and I think that we've got it on the exhibit now for 2017 or 2018, because it takes a while. That's the other thing that people have to understand is an exhibit, we don't just walk through the artifact storerooms and say, I'll take that painting and that bust and this and that and then go put it up. Exhibitions take research. They take conservation of objects. They take a 3-year cycle before you can really get anything up to do the research, to do the conservation, to get artifacts ready to hang on the wall. And then certain things can't stay on the wall too long. So we have to look at how many times has something been shown? Has it you know, it's like artifact years, like dog years, artifact years. How much light has it had in this year? That's why we have to be careful. So I'd like to see us do a great exhibit on the Mississippi River. Of course, I'd like to see, I think of an exhibit every single day. Every single day. I mean, I'm really pleased with our schedule over the next year because we'll be looking at the German experience in Louisiana history. We'll be looking at African-American history and the civil rights movement here. And St. Louis is a place just like Selma, Alabama, where we really have our own experiences for African-American history. We have a lot. I'd like to see us do an exhibit on the architecture of St. Louis, and we'll get a little bit in there in our 1875 exhibit that's coming up.
You mentioned African-American history, and it reminds me there was a piece in on St. Louis Public Radio the other day, indicating that some of the black arts institutions are interested in becoming part of a zoo museum district subset of some sort. Is this something that you could support?
Sure. You know, I think the voters have to support
it. Sure, of course.
You know, that becomes a voter's issue. But I think that that the African-American story in St. Louis is one of our watershed moments here in St. Louis. So that's a story that we try to tell all the way through the History Museum, because we see civil rights history. We see community history as the interaction of peoples of different cultures, different points of view. And that's what you've got to get across in an exhibit. Sure. But
I was surprised when you mentioned a moment ago that you have an artifacts room, or I've forgotten exactly what your words were, but it made me think that a lot of these things go into what I would call a garage, maybe, and are brought.
No.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Where is this place where the artifacts go to rest until they're brought back out again?
We have collection storage areas, and that's really what distinguishes a museum from a gallery and a museum from interior decorating, is that museums make the commitment when they accept an article to an artifact, a suit, a pair of shoes, is to keep it in their collections in perpetuity. And so we have collection warehouses. It's partly what's in the LRC, the old United Hebrew Temple.
Oh, yes.
That's
mm-hmm.
on Skinker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's our collection storage. And so that's one of the things we'll be doing more of, our members' tours behind the scenes. We just did one a couple weeks ago and took a group of about 30 members into collections. So you see how the clothing is housed. You see how the guns are housed. And every artifact, we are an accredited museum. About 4% of museums in the United States are accredited by the American Alliance of Museums. And as an accredited museum, we have to meet certain standards for the long-term housing of an artifact. Well, in a gallery, something goes in a commercial gallery, it's in for a short period of time. When something goes into the museum collection storage area, we have pledged as an accredited museum to maintain the temperature and humidity, the kind of box that it's in, that you wear gloves when you touch it. So
that would be almost as interesting to me, I think, seeing that storage area or those storage areas, as seeing some of the exhibits themselves.
You haven't asked me this question, but one of the things that I intend to do over the next couple of years is to make the process of exhibition mounting a much more public process, so that people see, how do we choose an artifact? Why did we say yes to this and no to that? How do we review text? What goes up on the wall goes through a tremendous editing and process for both the factual information and the tone, the voice of the exhibit. And that's one of the things I'd like to do, is make that a much more public, so that people understand, why does it cost so much to do an exhibit? It's all those steps in the process.
Yes. We're talking with Fran Levine, who is the new CEO and president of the Missouri History Museum. We're obviously talking about how the museum operates and what she brings to the table and her plans for the future. She's only been here for a couple of months, so as we indicated at the top of the program, still getting her sea legs to a certain degree. But if you've been listening, you know she has many ideas for what she wants to do in the immediate and long-term future. Back to continue our conversation. Once again, this is your opportunity to chat with Fran. If you'd like to do so, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with Fran Levine in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Fran Levine, who is the president and CEO of the Missouri History Museum. I wonder if African-American history in this part of the country has been, in general, covered adequately by such museums in recent years. Do you think so?
You know, I think that there's so much importance in focusing on what the civil rights era brought all of us as Americans. And so African-American history is the is the tip of a much bigger story. And, you know, I came of age in the civil rights era. So that's a time when my ascendancy as president of this museum couldn't have happened without the struggles of the civil rights era. The civil rights era is what gave African Americans and women and people of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual community the rights to live an open public life. So I think that for me, it's like saying, oh, you know, haven't we already heard all about history? You know, isn't history what happened yesterday? Everything that happened today was built on the struggles of that era. So to me, no, I don't think it's not about adequate. There's always a different way to look. There are new artifact collections. I mean, one of the collecting initiatives that I want to see us do is to really begin to collect the items, the posters, the newspapers, the artifacts about African-American history and the civil rights era here. We don't have very much in our collections. That's got to be a collecting initiative.
That's why I raised the issue, because it seems to me as an observer that this is glossed over or certainly not gotten into in any great detail.
And some of our kids have grown up at a time where they didn't know about Jim Crow laws here in this city. And I think they need to know what that was like for their parents or their grandparents or their great-grandparents to have lived through that kind of era. And as I say, our collections are not deep in that area, and they need to be deeper. And a couple of our curators will be working on just that, trying to figure out what do we need to add to our collections in perpetuity so that history of the civil rights struggle is never lost here. We're adding oral histories to the oral history collection, but we also need the artifacts that tell of that time.
Are there other things like this that you haven't mentioned that you want to get into?
I think environmental history. I'm particularly interested in an environmental history of the Mississippi River. I love the idea of, for me, one of the things that brought me here too was the confluence. Because the confluence of the Mississippi and the Missouri, it's like the confluence of history, the confluence of environmental history. I'd love to see us do an exhibit that looks at it and also that collects Mississippi River history. Not that we're ever going to be able to put a tugboat or a riverboat fully in the museum, but to tell that story of what it was like when those were the major transportation highways for this country.
There have been a couple of good books written recently just about that. We've had, I wish I could think of the one I'm trying to think of that we had the author on several months ago, but it was outstanding. They were finding shark's teeth, for instance, along the Mississippi riverbed because the oceans at one time came this far inland. In any case, Fran Levine is our guest, CEO and president of the Missouri History Museum. We have some calls. Let's go to the phones. We'll bring in Dave, caller from St. Louis. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, guys. I just had a quick question. First of all, you're talking about the civil rights movement, and really, there should be a lot more devoted to Laclede Town in the museum. And that's really why I called. I saw a photograph from a newspaper that said this was Laclede Town, and it was actually a picture of Laclede Town across the Laclede Park across the street. And I was trying to find out who I could talk to about clearing up something like that. I'm getting old enough that I've actually lived through some history in St. Louis. And who do we talk to about that sort of thing?
Well, I think there's a couple different things. If you want to contribute an oral history, you might want to talk to Jody Sewell. But we're also going to be doing some oral history recording sessions in the community where we use community events. And we just ordered tents that say Missouri History Museum. And Jody will be working with some of our curators to go out into the community and collect oral histories. If you look at our website, you'll find Jody's address. Be sure to get in touch with him. If you want to talk about the photography that we have or the photography that you think we should have, you should talk to our library and collection staff. I'm going to give you one person's name, but then we have several curators who you can work with. Chris Gordon, who is our chief librarian, is a person to talk to. And he has staff members who are working across the community to collect these kinds of stories, artifacts, and photographs that document the history.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's bring in Bruce calling from St. Louis. Bruce, go ahead. Are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead, Bruce.
More of a comment than a question. I notice when I visit the museum and go to the exhibits, the lighting, I feel like I'm in a funeral home. It's so subdued to protect those artifacts. And with all the kind of technology we have today in the lighting business, I would hope that the museum could find a way to upgrade the lighting so that it's a little brighter in there while also protecting some of the treasures.
You know, Bruce, that's something that museums struggle with all over. And part of it, it's the lighting and the temperature. So we're always playing with that balance between people comfort and artifact protection. The other thing that we always have to do is to jump up the typeface that we use for our labels. And that's one of my favorite issues because I can't read it if it's too small. And so we have to balance the lighting, the temperature, and the typeface for the protection of the artifacts and the comfort of the visitors. I'll certainly mention that, and I'm sure that our staff is listening, and I'll hear their views on where we can make changes. I can tell you right now, Louisiana Purchase will have very low light levels and cooler temperatures because of the antiquity of those national treasures.
You've got to be very excited for this material coming into your and into your space. I have an email here from Ed. He says he didn't get an adequate answer earlier on. We were talking about the previous problems with former President Bob Archibald. He wants to know what is in place to prevent it from happening again.
Oh, I think, you know, I'm not sure what he's referring to in particular, but I can tell you that the board and the ZMD and the Board of Trustees now have in place any expenditures over a certain dollar amount go through several different levels of review, and of course our obligation to have some more public hearing process on our plans. So I don't know exactly what he's thinking about, but I think you'll see more opportunities for public comment, and also our board's acting in concert on any expenditure.
I guess
more
disclosure. I guess the question really is: would it be possible for you to make a land deal to buy some land adjacent to the History Museum without anybody really knowing about it?
No.
I think you wouldn't
not
do
at
it.
All.
You wouldn't do it because you wouldn't do it. But could you do it if you wanted to?
No, I don't see how I could because there's no way to be able to access those kinds of funds and those kinds of commitments. I am not the only person who signs contracts. I'm not the only person who makes those kind of decisions. It became very clear that there's a governance process that requires more than one set of eyes. And I would say in that on the Del Mar property, some of that happened as well. I think some of it is way that story was told in the media was very different than what happened internally. But, you know, I wasn't here.
Yeah, but the changes have been made since then to prevent that from happening again.
Absolutely.
One other thing, I don't want to embarrass you, but I do know what your compensation is, and I'm not going to mention what it is, but I know it's two-thirds of what Mr. Archibald was making. You're the first female president. Does that bother you, a source of concern at all?
Are you saying you think I need a raise?
Absolutely.
I think that
some might say that you should be making as much as your predecessor.
You know what? I think that compensation was handled very differently 25 years ago. Bob didn't make what I make when he came in 25 years ago. And that compensation and compensation packages changed over time. So some of the things that I have in terms of my compensation package for vacation time and that kind of stuff wasn't part of a vacation compensation 25 years ago. I think that I am very pleased with my compensation package. I will always be pleased if somebody thinks I'm doing such a good job that they want to give more to the museum and to me. I think I'm fairly compensated, and I hope it's not the last time I get a raise in my life.
Let's go back to the phones and bring in Christy calling from Florence. And Christy, go ahead. You're on the air with Fran Levine.
Yes. Hi. I'm an enrolled tribal member of the Osage Nation and wanted to thank the Missouri History Museum for all the work this year as part of the STL 250 events to provide mechanisms for our tribe to also tell our story about being stewards of the land that is now St. Louis. And I was just curious. You know, we've had a kind of history with the museum in terms of being able to look at the artifacts that you all have in storage and other pieces, but curious about any interest on your behalf in the museum to continue all those relationships going forward and continue to try to help tell the story of the Native communities that were here earlier.
That's, of course, with my background as both an archaeologist and living in New Mexico, where I worked with 19 Pueblo nations and three Navajo and Apache reservations, it's very important to me. I have been talking about to our curators about a photographic collection that I know of Osage history. And I know that we will be talking with the Osage Nation about continuing that relationship. Very, very important to us. To me personally and to our curators and our staff is to continue that relationship. So I'm looking forward to meeting you, Christy, and the community.
What exactly do curators do?
That's a really good question. I have to say that curators are they're the coordinators of exhibitions. So they're the ones who do the research. And being a curator means being able to be a good writer, a good storyteller, but to see how that story is going to come together three-dimensionally. A lot of times people say, you should do an exhibit on X topic, but we don't have the collections. Mm-hmm. And if you go to a good museum exhibition, it's a balance between what you see, what you hear, what you can touch, what's inaccessible but available in cases. So doing an exhibition, the curator is the person who thinks about what's in our collections, make sure that our collection is developed so that we can tell the story into the future, like the civil rights and African American collection. Right now, we have great photography and oral history. We don't have three-dimensional objects. We don't have those signs that people grew up with, those terrible signs. We do have a lunch counter. So the curator is the person who makes sure that our collections reflect the history of our times and the history of what came before. They are the people who, as they write stories, reach into those storerooms and say, right now for the Louisiana Purchase, our archivists, our decorative arts exhibition curator, all of the different curators who are responsible for different areas have big curatorial meetings where they talk about what are we going to show to tell this story.
And how is it determined? We only have about a minute left, and I'm curious as to how you determine how long an exhibit is going to be on display, whether it's going to be 6 weeks or 6 months.
Some of it depends on the size of the exhibit. We try always to have exhibits during the school year that work with school curriculum. So, and some of it depends on how long we can show something, how long can it be in the light, and how much space it occupies.
In just a few seconds, it's important to bring in the next generation of museum goers. Very quickly, what's being done to bring the young ones in?
Oh my goodness, we have early childhood programs at the museum. We do so much for children and schools, and that's one of the things I'm tremendously proud of this museum for what we do.
Well, Fran Levine, it's been a pleasure meeting you and getting to know you, and welcome once again to St. Louis, somewhat belatedly. But good luck to you during your time as president and CEO of the Missouri History Museum.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about Opera Theater's world premiere of Ricky Ian Gordon and Royce Varick's 27, and about the St. Louis Fringe Festival. And in the next segment of Soundbites produced with Sauce Magazine, Steve will explore the best places, that is, to eat brunch in the area. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Ridley Pearson about his latest novel in his Risk Agent series, The Red Room. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Kyle Jacoby, Amanda Huntingfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.